So, good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining tonight. And for those who can, if you can turn on your video so I can see your face, that'd be lovely. And if not, that's fine, too.
Michael, I think you're muted.
Oh, I thought I... Sorry. Thank you, Michael. Thought I had unmuted. Well, as I was saying, how lovely to see you. And if you can, please turn on your video so I can see you. And if not, that's fine too. Whew. Well, as Michael said just a moment ago, this is our third talk on a very ancient teaching poem in the Zen tradition. The Jiumir Samadhi, or Song of the Jiumir Samadhi. And if you have listened to the two previous talks, you'll know that this certainly is not a readily approachable text. It's kind of confusing, jumping in. And just in case there's anyone just joining us for the first time, this text is available, this poem, on the Mountain Rain website under Events. And Song of the Jiumir Samadhi, you can download it and print it out at some point. So Dongshan, the author of this poem, or at least in the tradition, the poem is attributed to Dongshan. He used the images and metaphors that were very common in China during the 800s. And he used these to try and encourage his students and those who would come after to see beyond the kind of narrow confines of their everyday thinking and attitudes and to open to the full nature of reality. And there are many teaching poems, texts left by our ancestors in the Zen tradition, often with the same aim, the same desire to offer some aid, some help, both to students and to us, the people who have come afterwards. So before we pick up from where we left off last week, let's just review a few of the key points that the poem has illustrated for us so far. The Jiumir of the title is really a symbol of our Buddha nature, maybe our fundamental nature that's unrestrained by our conditioning, unobscured by our kind of conceptual projections, and free of our everyday lunacy. I think that's what the Jiumir means, free of our everyday lunacy. Now, the early Buddhist tradition, more or less, saw this world as a kind of a sad and relatively wretched place that is overcome. We overcome this, our place in this world, by purification and great effort. But Dongshan expounds a very different view. Or maybe it's not that different when we really look closely. Anyway, Dongshan expounds a view that the world and all it contains is actually whole and complete and intimate. Each part intimate with every other part. And we need only to open our Dharma eye to see it as it truly is. This reality is called tatata in Sanskrit, or translated into English as the thusness. Thusness or suchness. Translators choose one or the other. So through our Dharma eye, we come to see deeply and to acknowledge and live by the interbeing of all things recognizing both their relative aspect and their absolute aspect. And both aspects are just, we could make say, different perspectives of suchness, or the Buddha nature of all things. And in the poem, in the parts that we've covered so far, Dongshan gives the image of darkness to represent the undifferentiated. And he uses the image of light to symbolize the particularity of our everyday lives, everything we see. In the dark, everything seems to merge, and yet the distinctions are still present. And in the light, the variety of the world jumps forward, yet still connected and interdependent. And all of this is embraced in suchness, in thusness. So these are some of the key things that we've talked about in the last couple of sessions looking at this poem. So let's continue, kind of jump starting where we left off last week. It's a long poem, so I'm not sure if I can get it done one more time after this. Maybe take two. So yeah, I ask for your patience with this. So beginning with the line, I should have numbered these. Like a babe in the world, in five aspects complete, it does not go or come, nor rise, nor stand. Baba waba. Is anything said or not? Ultimately, it does not apprehend anything, because its speech is not yet correct. Well, talk about obscure and hard to grasp this line. But here, Dongshan uses the image of a child to illustrate thusness, or the absolute nature of everything. Perhaps I shouldn't say child, but actually a baby. Before a baby learns to speak. In this first line, the five aspects have also been translated as the five senses. Although in the traditional Buddhist understanding, we have six, right? The sixth one being the mind. The mind is the sixth. Anyway, one understanding may be the full childlike openness or baby-like openness to the world through the senses. And yet free. Free from judgment and discrimination. Just perceiving, interacting. This is the image I think Dongshan is trying to present to kind of push us a little bit closer to perhaps understanding what he's trying to convey with this word suchness. I was reading a little bit about babies, and some of the current research shows that babies first explore their bodies. Right, we've all seen little babies with their toes stuck in their mouth and that kind of thing. And to some extent, the world, of course, through their senses. So babies are beginning to explore all of this through sound, touch, taste, sight, hearing. And around the age two, they begin to develop what psychologists recognize as a sense of self. At least that's kind of some of the current thinking. So this struck a memory. In case 80 of the Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection of stories in the Zen tradition that are studied both in the Soto tradition and in the Rinzai tradition. So in case 80, a monk asked the famous teacher Zhaozhou about babies and their senses. And this is Zhaozhou's reply. I'm not going to go over to the whole thing in great detail, but this is his reply. Through its eyes, though its eyes can see and its ears can hear, It doesn't discriminate among the six sense objects. The sense objects. So there's the senses and then the objects that the senses perceive is what he's talking about here. And again, the sixth then in this case would be a thought, because the mind is considered one of the senses. At this time, it knows nothing of good and evil, superior and inferior, right and wrong, gain and loss. A student of the way must come again, like an infant. Then one cannot be moved by praise or blame, success or fame, trial or ease. Although one sees forms, one is the same as blind. Though one hears sounds, one is the same as deaf. He is like a fool, like an idiot. That's what Jiaozhou replies. So Jiaozhou here tells us that in this endless field of thusness, of unity, what is there to discriminate against or for? How can any comparison be made? And so just like a newborn babe, thusness does not go somewhere or come from a distant place. It does not rise up. It does not stand. Thusness has no changing position, but remains always present, whole, complete. I love this next line. Baba wawa, is anything said or not? Ultimately, it does not apprehend anything because its speech is not yet correct. Or another translation, for words are not yet accurate. The sutras, the many sutras in the Mahayana tradition, all the writings of the ancient teachers, are full of illustrations and explanations to describe the jewel mirror, to describe thusness, to describe Buddha nature. But just like the sounds from a baby before it can articulate anything, the sutras and writings really communicate only a little. Just a little meaning perhaps comes forward. The many teachings cannot satisfactorily explain to us what our Buddha nature truly is. The ancestors know what they have experienced, but there is no way they can express it or represent it so that we too can fully understand. And this poem, like all of the ancient teachings, it's like a finger pointing at the moon, as I mentioned last week. The teachers of old, out of, I think, very profound compassion, left us indications, left us markers to guide us on our own journey. But we have to take that journey ourselves. As one modern Zen teacher, known for his very earthy comments, said, "You cannot trade even a single fart with the next guy. Each and every one of us has to live out his, her, their own life." Well, in this verse, this passage, Dongshan, I think, is cautioning us not to venerate the words of the ancestors as expressions of the truth or as being holy in the sense of being revealed, kind of gifted by the divine. They are just fingers pointing the way, signposts for us to help us as we make the journey through our own life. So next, kind of couplet. It is like the six lines of the illumination hexagram. Relative and ultimate interact. Piled up, they make three. The complete transformation makes five. Whoa. So I'm going to show us a couple of slides here in just a moment. But the hexagram that's referred to here comes from the I Ching, the Book of Changes, a very, very early, very old classical Chinese text that began as a tool of divination and still has that function today. But it also, I think, evolved into a very deep philosophical text that offers a way to understand the workings of the universe. So the text is really a collection of commentaries, commentaries on 64 hexagrams made up of combinations of solid lines and broken lines. Broken lines meaning a line with a kind of gap in between. So let me just show you a quick slide here. Oops. I thought I did. Sorry, just give me 1 second here. Okay, ready. So there are 64 of these. They're made of trigrams. So you can see the broken and the single lines here in various combinations. I don't have them all here, but they make for a total of 64. Now, perhaps we consider this a complex system, perhaps, to understand the nature of the world and our place in it, along with its use as fortune-telling. And in some ways, I don't think it's that different from kind of medieval astrology or perhaps alchemy. It's a way of really drilling deep into the psyche. And the I Ching was familiar to most Chinese in medieval times, even those who were literate, because it was used in divination and you would go to see somebody who was skilled in the practice of the I Ching to divine things. So the illumination hexagram, this is one particular one, is composed of the fire trigram, which is repeated twice to form the illumination hexagram. I'll just show you a quick picture of that too here. So you can see solid, broken solid, solid, broken solid. So these two are repeated to each other, these two trigrams. It is said that the Li trigram, so this, the three and the three, the trigrams, are associated with the mind and with clarity. So perhaps that's one reason why Dongshan selected this. The lower trigram is said to represent the inner state of a person. And the upper trigram is the outer. So this hexagram, when they're combined, may symbolize illuminating the self and the world together at once. And one scholar that I read suggests that this hexagram operates like a mirror. The top and bottom trigrams, after all, are the same, mirroring each other. So in addition, according to the I Ching theory, the top trigram has the opposite valence to the bottom trigram. So in this hexagram, it represents both things that are the same and things that are different, both the relative and the ultimate. Now, all of that may be a little bit confusing, but that's okay. I don't think we really need to know all the details about what this hexagram represents. It's merely another symbol, a way of trying to help us understand that the relative and absolute are both here at the same moment, in the same time, same place. The line that is pretty confusing, piled up they make three, the complete transformation make five. This refers to a really elaborate way of working with and interpreting the trigrams, which is really much too complex and esoteric, I think, for us to get involved with tonight. But maybe we can appreciate this hexagram as really a powerful symbol of the relative and the boundless nature of reality, all at the same time. So the next lines, it is like the taste of the five-flavored herb, like a diamond thunderbolt. So here, Dongshan offers us yet other examples of mutuality and identity. The five-flavored herb refers to a plant that apparently has the five flavors of sweetness, bitterness, saltiness, acidicness, and acridness, kind of all five kind of together at once. Or I read another person that says it depends how they're cooked. The different flavors will come forward depending how this herb is pan-fried, steamed, boiled, broiled. We don't know. And another translator I read says this plant is actually the hyssop plant. And hyssop has a kind of a complex flavor, but it's kind of a licorice flavor, right, Kate? Mm. Yeah, kind of a licorice flavor. But it is a kind of a complex flavor, I must say. And then the diamond thunderbolt is what's called a vajra in Sanskrit, or doje in Tibetan. And it's a ritual implement of the tantric schools of Buddhism. And I'll just quickly show you a picture of that, just in case you're not familiar. Oops, okay. There. So it has, a typical vajra has three or five prongs. And again, symbolizing the interpenetration of the many and the one, this kind of unity of many and one. And it has many other uses in tantric Buddhism, which I don't understand. So you may have noticed, five appears in the section of this poem a lot. Five-flavored herb, the five-pronged vajra, etc., etc. And these are references to a description of the stages or ranks of awakening in our practice, according to the Soto Zen tradition. And these five ranks or five stages were articulated by Dongshan himself. So they're quite old. But these stages, which are not really stages, they each one expresses the interplay of the absolute and the relative in various ways. But they all come back to the fundamental non-dualism of our life. we can consider them kind of Dharma positions in how we express our understanding and awakening of this truth. But like the spokes of a wheel or the Eightfold Path, we can move from one to the other. Indeed, it is written that each contains the other, so there's no fixed or ultimate awakening. But again, here, for our purposes, we don't need to go into the details of these five ranks. Maybe in another talk, I will kind of explore them a little bit. Most teachers kind of downplay this idea of the five ranks that Dongshan talks about a little bit, including Dogen. Dogen says, don't get caught up in this idea of five ranks. Dogen says, remember, Dongshan taught, just this is it. So simple, so basic. Let's come back to there. Okay. Next line. Subtly included within the true, inquiry and response come up together. So another translation of this very same line from the Chinese is this. Wondrously embraced within the real, drumming and singing begin together. Now, this may give you a good idea of how challenging translating classical Chinese can be. So, what is subtly included within the true or wondrously embraced within the real? In the Zen tradition describes the distance between awakening and delusion as thin as a piece or a sheet of rice paper. Or as Dogen wrote in his work, the Fukan Zazengi, and I'm quoting now, and yet if there is the slightest discrepancy, the way is as distant from heaven, is as distant as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. What we think we have lost or need to complete has always been right here. In practicing the way, we rediscover, we recover, or we awaken to the already existing harmony that embraces both the relative and the absolute, that embraces life and death, embraces the myriad things and boundlessness, embraces the me that's in here and the you out there. So intimate, so close are these seeming dualities. It is as if inquiry and response arise together. Just to ask the question is to arrive. What is this? Who am I? What is it? Ask these questions and notice the sense of inquiry, what it feels like before the rational mind kind of leaps in. Notice just asking the question. For a moment or two, there is a spaciousness, a groundlessness, a kind of not knowing without subject or object. Again, just for a moment or two before the internal voice kicks in, before the rational mind starts kicking in, before the judgments, etc., begin to arise. Just to ask the question. In our Zazen, and at times I think in our daily life, that sheet of paper tears a little. And for a moment or two, body and mind drop away. We rediscover, we uncover the already existing harmony and intimacy between self and other, me and you, we and them. Dogen writes that at that moment, we are verified by all things. And sometimes it happens just for a moment or two in Zazen, and sometimes maybe just out walking under a tree, feeling the rain on our face. And just at that moment, everything tells us we are alive. And we are complete. So next line. Communing with the source, travel the pathways, embrace the territory, and treasure the road. So this line expresses the oneness of practice and realization that can seem so bizarre and strange to us at first. In this line, the words communing and travel are translations of actually the same word in Chinese, which can also be translated as penetrating. So the first part of this line could be something like penetrate the source and travel the pathways, for example. Again, going back to Dogen's Fukan Zazengi, we find this line. The way is basically perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent upon practice and realization? So here Dogen expresses the same kind of paradox. The way, the source is all-pervading. Yet we're often caught in a sense of somehow disconnection. At times, loneliness, or even at times, abandonment. How do we open to that all-pervading way Dogen writes about? After all, we are not newborn babes, free of judgment and discrimination. We are not free of our strong reactions and impulses that come from the ego. And yet, if we do take up the view that our practice is a kind of self-help project, we're already knee-deep in mud. The ego, our mind, quickly creates the dichotomy of the jeweled mirror being somewhere out there, elsewhere. And right now, I am so limited. My life is broken. That's what our mind does, rather than opening to the boundlessness. We say, maybe later, after a few more years of practice. So Dongshan cautions us, please return again and again to the source. Walk the pathways of practice, and through ongoing effort, become intimate with the territory and the road of thusness. Last little line here. Respecting this is fortunate. Do not neglect it. Now this line is also quite challenging to translate from the Chinese, and several translators have commented that their understanding of the Chinese is partly guesswork here. But going with this translation and my own kind of puzzling over the Chinese, here's a few thoughts. There is a story in the early Buddhist literature, maybe you've heard this one before, of the Buddha when he's really emphasizing the preciousness and rarity of human birth. And he says something like, imagine there's a certain blind turtle who lives at the bottom of a vast ocean, who surfaces only once every 100 years for air. And floating randomly around this ocean is a yolk. And as often as that blind turtle at the bottom of the ocean happens to rise his head through the hole of the yolk, when he comes up to take his breath, that's the likelihood of being born in human form. Anyway, all kinds of versions of that story. To be born human and to encounter the Buddhist teachings is indeed, I believe, rare and fortunate. And Dongshan admonishes us to respect our good fortune. Don't waste it. And travel the pathways of practice. Travel the pathways of practice. Well, maybe this is not quite so obvious as it may seem at first. We need to ask ourselves, what is it to travel the pathways of practice? And while there are good guidelines and suggestions from the past and present teachers, each of us must take up the task of realizing the practices that our own life calls for. Zazen, chanting, bowing, upholding the precepts, study, helping others, making vows, these are all part of our tradition. But maybe for you, not neglecting the way includes raising children, creating art, periods of solitude, working for social justice, promoting interfaith understanding, tending the elderly and the sick, sweeping the floor, weeding the garden, scrubbing pots, changing the diapers of the very elderly. Dogen Zenji wrote in the Tenzo Kyokan, another one of his great works, it's called Instructions to the Cook in English, of the great importance of cultivating joyful mind, parental mind, and magnanimous mind. And joyful mind is the mind of gratitude, dedicating one's actions for the benefit of all beings. Parental mind is to see and treat all beings with profound love as parents for their only child. And magnanimous mind is not to be contentious, but have a mind like a great ocean or great mountains. With these attitudes or minds, Dogen tells us, then we don't wander off the pathways of practice, no matter what our daily activities are, no matter what our life calls us to take up as practice. So I'm going to stop here in the poem for tonight. And as is our want, I'm going to divide us up into groups and again give you some time to just talk to each other. And I think everyone here is familiar with the process. So each person will have about 3 minutes. And I'd like you to please time yourselves. And here are two questions to reflect on. So in the extraordinary and mundane events of our life, how do we not neglect the wholeness of our being? In the extraordinary and the mundane events of your life, how do you not neglect the wholeness of your being? Or, during the busyness of life, or the times of gray flatness that you find yourselves in, a kind of place of doldrums, how do you return to the joyful mind of practice? How do you find that path back? Or you can talk about something else, maybe that arose for you in the poem. Okay, so